we were dealing with this third verse, second verse of the fourth chapter of the text, Godavada's Manduki Karika. As I said earlier, the Upanishads try to establish essentially the unity of existence, the oneness of creation, the unity of human family. And for that, these ancient texts generally have one specific method, which is mostly found in the Upanishadic Vedantic literature. In Sanskrit, it's called Adhyaropa and Apavada. Now, how do we establish the unity of creation, unity of existence? First, we have to establish that this manifoldness, the multiplicity, the plurality of the phenomenal world is not absolutely real. It has got only relative value. This is the first principle. There is only one reality which is absolutely real, which is Atman or consciousness or the universal soul. But then the question arises, why do we see the manifoldness? Why do we experience this plurality or duality or manifoldness of different things in this world? So that's the first step. Coming down to the level of empirical world, empirical experience, and trying to analyze the so-called manifoldness or plurality of experiences. And then going deeper, trying to establish the fact that manifoldness or plurality are only of relative value, they have got only relative ontological status. Behind this manifoldness, there is unity or oneness. This is the next step. So these are the two steps that you find in Vedantic literature. First, coming down to the empirical experience and trying to understand and analyze this manifoldness, the empirical entities. Then, going deeper by way of analyzing and explaining the reality of the manifoldness. What is the reality behind manifoldness? The reality behind manifoldness or plurality or duality is that they are not eternally real. They have only relative status. So establishing the unity is the second step. Analyzing the plurality is the first step. Now, in this particular text, that is Mandukya Karika that we are studying, and also the original foundational work, which is Mandukya Upanishad, which has got only 12 verses, the author takes a different approach, not the approach that I mentioned now. The approach is somewhat different. The author tries to come down to our normal human experiences, the three states of our experiences. The three states are waking state, dream state, and deep sleep state. Then analyze the ontological value, the reality of these experiences. This method is special to this text, the Mandukya Upanishad. That is the original work, which has got only 12 verses. And the Mandukya Karika, which we are reading now, which is a commentary in verses, in metrical form, on the original Mandukya Upanishad. that many of those of you who didn't attend the class right from the beginning may not have noticed this aspect. The text we are reading is called Mandukya Kariga or Gaudapada's Kariga. Gaudapada was a great Vedantin who lived sometime in 6th century AD, and he wrote this famous book, which is in Sanskrit, in metrical form, in verses, not in prose. Total, there are 215 verses which constitute a commentary on the original Upanishad. The Upanishad is part of Atharva Veda. The Upanishad itself contains only 12 verses. We call mantras because they are not really metrical form, not in metrical form. They don't conform to the rules and principles of meter in Sanskrit. In Sanskrit, there are innumerable meters. So, the original text is a bit unconventional because the language is very ancient. We have to think of an age maybe 4000 BC, 6000 years back. The original text may be around 6000 years back. Mandukya Upanishad, which is neither prose, strictly speaking, nor verse. Because that work came into existence long before the Sanskrit language and its grammatical principles were standardized by a great grammarian in 7th century BC. His name is Panini Ashtadhyayi. That is a famous grammatical work in Sanskrit, which contains more than 4,000 not sentences, words. If you read, you won't understand. We won't understand anything. You see, I can give an example. The last, it is called sutra, pithic statements. Pithic statements. The last sutra is a. Now, what do you make out of that? This is the last sutra of Panini. And Panini formulated more than 4,000 sutras. Sutras means pithic statement. Statement is not in, may not be a single, it may not be a full word even. Sometimes there will be a few words, like a phrase. Sometimes it may be just a few letters, like that he wrote. And there were innumerable commentaries on this original work. I mean, Panini's Ashtadhyayi. Ashtadhyayi means a grammatical work consisting of 8 chapters divided into innumerable pithic statements, which may be in the form of a phrase, maybe just a word, or maybe a few letters, which practically do not mean anything to the uninitiated, to those who have not formally introduced the technique. This became a great scientific discovery. Now, mind you, not a linguistic or philological discovery, a scientific discovery for the grammarians in 19th century. When the German grammarians, they took initiative in introducing this marvelous piece of human genius to Western world in 19th century. There are innumerable translations, and it was the German Indologists and grammarians who took initiative in introducing this marvelous piece of genius to Western world. Remember, Panini lived 200 years before Thales, the first recorded philosopher in Greek thought. Who lived 100 years before Buddha. Panini lived 250 years before Thales, the first recorded great Greek thinker, who lived maybe in the 6th century BC. So I'm just giving an example. Now the original verses, which are only 12 in number, do not conform to any standardized grammatical rule. Because I just want to give an idea of the whole text, especially for those who started coming from the last class onwards. The original Vedic literature was not exactly in metrical form. It was a purely unconventional language. So this man, this great Panini, he was a great professor in a university in what is now Pakistan, West Punjab. It's called Takshashila. Originally, he was born in an area between Pakistan and Afghanistan border. So this man was the most brilliant disciple of his teacher. So his teacher had great expectations from this brilliant disciple. And one day his teacher heard that this man was going to marry. The teacher should have come and perhaps presented him marriage, you give a gift, something like that. But the teacher's gift was somewhat different. He asked his other disciples, "You bring that man here, young man, who is about to marry." And this man came. Panini's teacher did not want him to marry and settle down as an ordinary person. Panini's teacher had great expectations from his disciple. He had another idea in mind. So the moment he heard that his guru was calling, his teacher was calling, Panini rushed to the teacher's home and asked, "What do you want me to do? You start right now and travel all over Indian subcontinent, which includes today's Indian subcontinent, Bangladesh, Pakistan, most Afghanistan, also part of Indian subcontinent at that time culturally. That was the language, Sanskrit was the language. Vedas were very, very popular. Afghanistan and today's Pakistan were also places where Vedic culture was very much prevalent in those days. So his teacher asked him, "You go around all of the subcontinent and try to study all the different vernacular forms and dialects of Sanskrit language." He had already had become a great master of Sanskrit. Try to find out the differences and also similarities. Then write a book, and that book is going to be the Bible of modern Sanskrit grammar. And he said, so that's a way to standardize Sanskrit language. There were innumerable vernaculars and dialectical varieties prevalent in India at that time. And he gave up his plan to start an householder's life and left his guru's place and traveled for decades. And by the time he became somewhat 65, 70 years old, he returned. And then he spent the rest of his lifetime in writing this great grammatical work, which is called Ashtadhyayi. And he wrote in the form of these pithic statements. But while writing, he also taught his disciples, Panini taught his disciples, how to interpret these pithic statements, which contain the wonderful, almost miraculous rules of Sanskrit grammar, which is supposed to be one of the most, maybe not one of the best and most perfect system of grammatical thinking that's known to human civilization. So the original verses that we studied maybe several months back are part of Atharva Veda, and this Vedic literature was prevalent 3,000, 4,000 years before Panini's birth. But Gaudapada's language is different. It confirmed to, all the verses confirmed to the Panini's system of grammar. So I was just giving an introduction to the great work that we are dealing with. So it has got four sections. The first section deals with the theology of Vedanta philosophy, let us say that, because it's an exposition of the canonical literature. Canonical literature of Mandukya is Mandukya Upanishad. In the second chapter, Gaudapada establishes that Atman or Brahman or consciousness is the only reality. This world, as we live in, as we experience, is not permanent. It is subject to changes. It comes and goes. Worries, happiness, grief, sorrow, life, death, all these are different levels in this flow of fluctuations and changes. Behind this change, there is one changeless reality, that's Atman. In the third chapter, he emphasized this point, but he stresses the fact that Atman is the only reality, everything else is being absolutely non-real, it is as good as unreal. So, his greater successor, Shankaracharya. Shankaracharya's Advaita system is more compact, in a way it is much more complete in the sense, while establishing the fact that Atman or consciousness is the only reality. This body, this world, the senses, all these come and go. While establishing this fact, Shankaracharya stressed that this empirical world as a status but only relative. But that concession you find in Shankaracharya's work. But Gaudapada doesn't ignore this, but he only stresses the fact Atman is the only reality. He doesn't emphatically try to explain the relativity of empirical world. He only stresses the fact that Atman is the only reality. In the fourth section, we find Gaudapada explains what is called ontosoteriology of Upanishad philosophy. As I gave the illustration, the beginning itself, Gaudapada uses an illustration, a simile. The simile is fire circle. Suppose you hold in your hand a stick with fire on one end and you go on rotating. Depending upon the way you rotate, the fire cycle assumes different forms. Sometimes you feel there's a square, sometimes you feel there's a circle. You can have any kind of external forms, depending upon how you rotate the torch, the lighter torch. Now, Gaudapada asked the question, what about these shapes and size, these shapes and different forms of fire that appear to come into existence when you rotate the lighter torch very fast? Suppose you would rotate like this, a circle appears to come into existence. And if you do in a different way, it may be a square. And if you stand quiet, then there is neither the circle nor square. Now, where does this circle disappear when you sit quiet? And where does it originate from? So, Gaudapada's answer is, first of all, there was no circle at all. It was only an appearance. Similarly, this phenomenal world, this empirical world is only an appearance. This is one important principle. How do we understand this? You analyze the world in which we are living. There is nothing in this world which is not subject to change. Can we call something which is constantly changing real? You can use the word real with small letter R, but you can't use the capital letter R. If you want to use the capital letter R, it should be absolutely real. And what is absolutely real can neither come into existence and it can never cease to exist. If it is absolutely real, there should not be any point of time when it did not exist. So how can it come into existence? Because coming into existence is a transition, is a change from a state of non-existence to a state of existence. So Gaudapada says, this phenomenal world is only an appearance created by name and form. Now think of the lighter torch. If you rotate the lighter torch in a round shape, you feel a circle comes into existence. And if you rotate it in a different way, maybe a square-shaped object, you can call it a circle. So it has a name and a form also. You may think this circle may come into existence and vanish within a few seconds. Gaudapada says the same is true of the universe in which we are living. The time is little longer. Universe may be 13.8 billion years or maybe several billions of years. This lighter circle may be for a few seconds. But both belong to time. So anything which belongs to time is non-eternal. Anything which belongs to time is non-eternal. It cannot be permanent. And anything which occupies a space is non-eternal. It is defined by the space. And anything which is caused by something else is not eternal, because that is only an effect of something which is its cause. So Gaudapada says, this Atman, the Supreme Consciousness, is the only reality which is absolutely real. His greater successor, Shankaracharya, said the same thing, but he also came down to the relative plane and tried to explain the phenomenal world and said, you live in this phenomenal world, the empirical world, though it is non-eternal, still it is relative. And living in this world, we can practice meditation, we can undergo spiritual disciplines, we can practice sense control, and through these spiritual practices, you can evolve spiritually, and gradually you will realize that you are not this body or the psychophysical mechanisms, you are the omnipresent reality. But Gaudapada doesn't give that concession. He only emphatically makes the point that Atman or Supreme Consciousness is the only reality, and it is neither born and it is not subject to death. Now it is something very interesting. Now it has got a great moral value in our daily life. That is the other aspect of Advaita. Sometimes Advaita is presented, unfortunately, and misunderstood by many people to be some kind of a doctrine or a theory. But it is very much a factor of daily life. Most of the problems that we face in this world at the individual level, if you ask the question to yourself, you find are related to the strong conviction, I am this body, or maybe the mind, or maybe the intellect, and then this world is eternal. We may read books, I think no well-educated scientist can openly make a proclamation that this world in which we are living is eternal. Because then you have to break science, you have to deny the scientific discoveries, because this universe came into existence sometime in the past, and it may become something else maybe after several millions of years. Now, how can it be eternal? And remember, if you want to call something eternal, it should be absolutely real. If it is to be called absolutely real, it should not be subject to birth, and it should not be subject to destruction. It is eternal, everlasting. So Gaudapada says, this Atman is the only reality, and everything else is only of empirical value. So this, the moral import of this philosophy is, if we can keep some time in our mind that this world in which we are struggling for money and wealth, status, the world which worries, causes so much of worry and grief, which causes so much of competition and struggle, and so much of anxiety and misery, sometimes even violence and injustice, this world is, after all, a changing phenomenon. This is the teaching of Advaita. Now contrast this teaching to the teachings of ordinary religious ideas, where you believe God created this world. Now suddenly science will come and tell you, well, if you believe in creationism, you are violating Darwin's theory. So how can you reconcile Darwin's theory and creationism? Again, how can we reconcile the apparent incompatibility between an all-merciful God in whom we live, whom you look upon as our protector, and this cruel, miserable world with all the problems and worries? Why should a merciful God create this world? So going beyond all this, Gaudapada doesn't deny, Advaita doesn't reject the ideas of creator God or organized religions. What Advaita does is perfectly all right, but there's a higher way of looking at things. There's a higher way of looking at things. Advaita doesn't reject anything. In fact, that's one of the fundamental principles of Gaudapada. As I said earlier, you know, those who believe in one doctrine related to one particular ideology or theology has to reject every other doctrine. But Advaita breaks all these walls of distinctions and differences. It says, all these are fine, but you look at the world and look at the way we are living. The world is changing, so behind this changing world, there should be an absolute reality. So created God is real, perfectly all right. There is nothing wrong against that argument. But there is a higher way of looking at things. And when you evolve spiritually, you find, as we evolve spiritually, our vision and understanding becomes more and more clear. So from now onwards, in a few verses, Gaudapada is trying to present before you certain arguments about the creation of the world. You can find different ideas, sometimes conflicting ideas, of creation, existence, cosmology and cosmogony prevalent in ancient Indian philosophical systems. That's what we are going to deal with. It may look a bit academic, but those who are really interested in the philosophical and metaphysical aspects of Advaita will find this very interesting. Now, Gaudapada here points out certain views. So you can look at the third verse. Bhudasya jadim ichchandi vadina kejit evahi abhudasya apare dhiraha vivadanta parasparam. Now, Gaudapada makes an interesting point. In fact, he made this point in the earlier chapter. He says, there are bound to be quarrels and conflicts so long as you limit yourself within a boundary and erect walls around you. And then assume that all other people are also living in small little shells, erecting walls around them. Now, conflicts and differences are invariable so long as we look upon this world as real and this world as something created by God, and then there will be difference of views. But the moment we realize that behind this idea of a personal creator, there is a higher idea, higher approach. And this higher approach is this. The whole world is pervaded by one supreme spiritual principle, that is the immanent, omnipresent consciousness or Atman. This view breaks all the barriers and walls around us. So, to give an example of how people with limited views fight among themselves, and how Advaitins, those who believe in this kind of universal spiritual philosophy, do not fight with anyone because they look upon the whole human family as one spiritual family. But who, with whom to fight? You are not different from anybody else. The same Atman is present in all human beings and also in the whole creation. So with whom to fight? You cannot fight with yourself. This unity based on the highest spiritual humanism is the essence of Advaita. But those who do not understand this, what they do, Gaudapada is giving an example. There are people who believe that this world comes into existence. It already exists, but it becomes manifest. And it is reality. That's one view. In fact, this view is technically called, in Indian philosophy, it's called Satkaryavada, a school of philosophers, mostly Sankhyas. Sankhyas, one ancient school of Indian philosophy, which is, the Sankhya did not believe in a God who creates this world and supervises his creation and then sends them to heaven and hell. They didn't believe in that sort of idea. They believed that one reality, supreme reality, which they call Prakriti, evolves into all these beings. It itself becomes all these things. Like a seed, for example, becomes a tree. The tree is already involved, is already present in the tree. In the seed. When you plant a seed, pour water, the faculty of the seed to evolve into this huge tree manifests itself, and the seed becomes a tree. Now, where does the tree exist? It existed in the seed. Similarly, something which already exists manifests, comes into existence. This is the view of one school of philosophers. It's called they believe in a kind of evolution. These ancient Sankhyas, they believed that there are altogether two fundamental realities. That's their ontology, Prakriti and Purusha. From Prakriti, which they call also Prathanam, the entire universe comes into existence. As a process of evolution, intellect, mind, senses of perception, senses of action, five subtle elements, and from them the five gross elements which constitute the phenomenal empirical world. All these evolve from that one reality. They don't give much importance to God. There are some Sankhya philosophers who denied existence of God. There are several others who did not deny, who did not affirm either, but they believed in some kind of evolution. Swami Vivekananda, when he gave a series of lectures in this country in the later in the last decade of 19th century, refers to the Sankhya philosophy, and many were highly impressed because Swami Vivekananda told them, see, nothing really comes into existence unless it has already existed. What never exists can never come into existence. Now, something which is absolutely non-existent can never come into existence. So whatever appears to exist already exists in an involved form. In the Swami Vivekananda later brought out this theory of involution. Later this idea was taken up by some scientists in 20th century. Sometimes they did not acknowledge it. So in the philosophy of George Santayana and quite a few others, William James, whom Swami Vivekananda himself met, he had intimate conversations with them. So this idea of involution, that is, the world in which we are living already exists in a subtle form, and from subtle form it evolves into gross form and becomes this manifold world or manifold names and forms. And then again it will go back to its subtle form. So going back is from gross to subtle, and evolution is from subtle to gross. So this was his theory. Because in the later half of 19th century, many scientists and well-educated people had already started challenging the ideas of creation. God creating this world in a specific, well-structured, with well-planned manner. It was it appeared to be somewhat opposed to modern intelligence and modern scientific spirit in the later half of 19th century. In fact, that kind of revolt against the old theological views was much more manifest in America than even perhaps in Europe, where evolution theory first became popular among the intellectuals, the elites of European societies, especially England, later France and Germany and other countries. But in the later half of 19th century, maybe due to the influence of transcendentalists and also the Unitarian Universalists, the idea that the world is not altogether a new creation, it is not something which somebody creates out of nothingness, like a pot, of course it cannot be pot maker making a pot may not be the right simile here. God just somebody who just wants and suddenly things come into existence. It cannot be like that. This idea behind. So Swami Vivekananda explaining this idea, explained that there is no creation really speaking, there is only projection. What we normally call creation is in fact projection. Projection means something manifests in gross form. Something which already exists in subtle form begins to manifest in gross form. So if it comes from its subtle cause, then it should already exist in subtle form in the original cause. And then this gross form may go back to subtle form. Maybe we don't know what happens after several billions of years if you are thinking of the global warming, if temperature increases, again the universe may go back to gaseous form, subtle form, and again after several billions of years, again water, oxygen, amoeba, the whole game may start again. And in fact, this is a theory, kind of everything is cyclic order. This is a fundamental principle we have to remember. This is acceptable Vedanta and also Sankhya philosophy. The world doesn't travel in a straight line progression. Not only the cosmos, but also human beings, both travel in cyclic form. So this can be explained in individual cases, and also at the micro level, and also at the macro level. So as I said, the world emerges, becomes manifest which we call evolution, and may go back to its subtle form. It's called involution, going back. So if it, and again the cycle continues. So also human beings, we are born, we live, we die, and then we are reborn, and this journey continues. So at a micro level, at the individual level, we are traveling in a circle. And at the macro level, the universe also undergoes projection, manifestation, then going back to its subtle form, and again, reprojection. It is not something that creates, and then all human beings travel in a straight, and there is a dead end at the end of the life, either go to hell or heaven. After all, there is an element of terrible injustice. You know, you get only one chance in your life. There is an element of great injustice. But Vedanta says not one chance. If you do a little spiritual practice in this life and then forget for the rest of your life, you are not lost. You put some money in the bank and later you can draw your check. So next life, whatever little spiritual practices you do, not only spiritual practices, you help a poor man, you help somebody to cross the street, a blind man or something, a blind woman. Even the little bit of good deeds that we do will create a spiritual bank, and that will help us to continue our progress in life, in next life. So the micro level, birth, life, death, rebirth. And at the macro level, what we call projection, that is coming of the external world, manifestation from the gross to subtle, from the subtle to gross, that is evolution. Then the gross goes back to its subtle form, that is involution. So this idea behind. Now here, Gaudapada is referring to one school of philosophy called Sankhyas, who were originally evolutionists. And you have to remember, their most important work, the teachings of Kapila. Kapila was a great philosopher, maybe one of the earliest Indian philosophers. But his original works are not available. We may have lost. But his later students and followers wrote books like Sankhya Karika, which are available, where they explain this Parinama Siddhanta, I mean the theory of evolution. Siddhanta of evolution. Parinama means evolution. I mean the cause becomes effect, and effect goes back to the cause. Now, the difference between these evolutionists and Vedantins is this. Evolutionists believe that the cause actually becomes the effect. Vedantins believe the cause doesn't really transform itself into the effect. It appears to have become transformed. So, see, just like a pot maker making a pot. We can't say that that the pot that is sitting in front of you is totally different from the clay from which the pot maker has made the pot, or the golden ornaments that you are wearing is entirely different from the gold out of which it's made. What is the golden ornament, and what is the difference between golden ornament and the gold from which it is made? The gold has no form. Gold ornament has a definite form, so it's got a different name also. You may ring or necklace, whatever you may call. So also pot. Pot is nothing but clay plus a special form and a special name. That's all. This is the Vedantins' view. So Vedantins believe this world itself, in its true form, in its real form, devoid of its association with name and form, is Brahman, is Atman, consciousness. So Vedanta doesn't reject the world. Vedanta only asks you to open your mind, intellect, and your eyes and analyze the world. The world, as we understand, is associated with name and form, and as such, it is subject to changes. This changing entity, empirical world, is not eternal, but if you can look upon the world without its association with name and form, then you can look at the world and see Brahman or Atman. You can see this in Ramana Maharshi's picture, those of you have seen. See, look at Ramana Maharshi. What is he staring at? What is he looking at? You can see. He's not looking at anything. So it is called, even when you are sitting somewhere staring at you, he doesn't close his eyes like Buddha. Even when he looks at the world, he sees Brahman only, Atman only. Because a goldsmith, when he looks at your golden ornament, if you go to him to sell your ornament, he doesn't much bother about the shape or size or anything. If he really wants to convert that into real gold, then he only weighs its gold content, quality of gold from out of which it's made. That is how he judges things. He doesn't care for the name and form, whatever name you may call in different languages, he doesn't bother. So, for a spiritually evolved person of realization, the world is not something to be rejected. The world is something in which we can live, but we need the world will not worry us if we look upon this world as something empirical, something subject to changes in association with name and form. But along with that, we will also imagine there should be a world in its real form without any association with name and form, and that is Atman itself. This is the Vedanta approach. So, Buddhasya Jati Michyanti, maybe this verse, some of you may not have the book with you. So, Gaudapada is first referring to a school of evolutionists who are known as Sankhya school of philosophy, who believed that from one of the two fundamental ontological realities in which they believed, the world evolves. And this evolution means real transformation. They said the effect cannot go back to its cause, which is where Vedanta steps in and says, no, you are wrong. If you say that pot cannot go back to its clay form, you are wrong, because you break it, it is clay only. A golden necklace or ring, you melt it, it becomes gold again. So it is not real transformation, it is only apparent transformation. So transformation is not real, transformation is only apparent. This is the view of Vedantins. Transformation is real, this is the view of the Sankhyas. Then for academic interest, Gaudapada is referring to another school of philosophers. It's something very interesting. They were school of logicians. You know. Some of you must have heard the name atomists, Indian school of atomism. Vaisheshikas, they believed the whole world is created by minute atoms. So, they were called Vaisheshikas, atomists. And they were not very different in some of their views with another school of philosophers, from another school of philosophers. They called logicians. So the school of logicians, this Gautama was the ancient sage, who was the original teacher of this Indian school of logic, this is Gautama. And the Indian school of atomism originally was taught by a great philosopher. His name was Kanada. They all lived maybe in 3000 BC around that time. Of course, their works are still available, not in metrical form. As I said, you know, some words, phrases, sometimes in full sentences, but in the old archaic Sanskrit language. Now, these people had a different theory. That is very funny. You know why? What you know, Gaudapada's intention of presenting before you all these conflicting theories. How ridiculous these theories are, that's what he wants to show you. Because these people believe the world was created and the world is real. The world is an entity which will be with us all the time. So, in fact, different schools of philosophers who all believed in the reality of creation of the world were fighting among themselves, each cancelling the other, each neutralizing the other. So Gaudapada is presenting before us, see, these are all various theories of creation. And how absolutely ridiculous each theory is, because each theoretician, each philosopher is questioned and challenged by an equally brilliant philosopher. And they have conflicting and contradictory views. Another person says, see, abhudasya apare dhiraha vividanta parasparam. Now, another school of philosophy, they say, anything that is created in this world is a new entity. Now, we can think of this. You think of cloth, a piece of cloth, shirt, for example, cotton shirt. Now, cotton shirt is made of thread, which comes from cotton. Now, what are the different ingredients which are involved in the production of a cotton cloth? Cotton threads are there, no doubt. Then the person who produces this cloth. And also, there are certain instruments which are necessary for this production. Now, most philosophers agree that the finished shirt is different from the person who has produced the shirt. The person is a person, individual person, he uses machines to produce the shirt. The shirt is not the same as the person who produces it. The person is called nimitta karanam or efficient cause. In English, logic, in Western logic, called efficient cause. Maybe the tailor, you can call the tailor. All this included. And there are certain machineries required, which are called auxiliary causes, secondary causes. Many types of machinery and other things involved in the production, factory and all these things. Auxiliary causes, we call. But what about the thread? The thread is, we call it upadana karanam, or material cause. Like clay is the material cause of a pot that is made from the clay. So, all will agree that a pot is different from the pot maker, who is the efficient cause. In Gautama's Nyaya philosophy, logic, school of logic, it is called nimitta karanam, means efficient cause, the pot maker. And he needs some instrument, some machinery, to produce this pot from the clay. Because asamavayi karanam, you can say, secondary auxiliary causes. But what about the clay? The clay cannot be very different from the pot, because when the pot is sitting in front of you, it is clay only, clay plus a form, and when it gets a form, you give it name pot, that's all. Now, there are some philosophers who tell you the clay has no relationship at all with the pot. So that school of philosophers, they call Indian logicians. That's their view. The earlier evolutionists, like Sankhya said, the effect was already involved in cause. Cause already contained in it the effect. This says, you know, the thread contains in it the shirt. The shirt is made of thread. Or maybe the clay contains in it the pot, because the pot is made from clay. Now, there are some philosophers, the Indian logicians, it's called Gautama's Nyaya philosophy, and Kanada's, their atomism is called Indian atomism. They believe the world is created by, constituted by different atoms, creation. You see, they have a very intricate system of philosophy. In many ways, there are many physicists who argue that it comes very close to modern physics. But I'm not a physicist, so I won't dare to enter that area. But there have been many Western thinkers who try to argue that many of the modern theories were anticipated in the old Vaisheshika system of philosophy or Indian Thomism of Kanada. But some of their views are quite illogical. The argument is the pot has no direct relationship with clay. It's called Samavayi Karanam. I won't tax you with these technical terms. Because, in other words, the effect has no connection, no relationship with the material cause. Material cause is clay, effect is the pot. And you know the reasons they give. They say, you cannot use clay for bringing water. So practical utility, we call vyavahariga buddhi. You cannot use clay for bringing water. For that, you need a glass made of clay or a pot. Again, go to the other illustration. The cloth and the threads. Threads are many, but cloth is one. Hundreds or thousands of threads may constitute one shirt. So there is Sankhya Beda, the difference that with regard to number and the difference with regard to utility. And then, but suppose you have produced a pot, you don't call it clay, you call it pot. So you got a different name. So they say, these Indian atomists and Indian logicians, these two schools of philosophy, the school of Kanada and the school of Gautama, they say, the effect is altogether a new creation, a new production. Therefore, it is real. They are all equally opposed to the views of Vedantins or Advaita. So here, Gaudapada is presenting before you two opposing schools of philosophy. One school arguing that effect already is contained in the cause only becomes the effect, but that becoming is a real transformation, which is called Parinamavada, means the theory of evolution. The cause evolves into effect. So the effect is already contained, it already exists, pre-exists in the cause. Then Indian atomists and then logicians, they argued, no, the effect is entirely different because the effect has a different use, it has got a different name, it has got a different dimension. So all these make the effect altogether a new creation, a new product, without any connection or association with the material cause. This is, so Gaudapada has presented before you two non-Advaitic, non-dualistic philosophers who argue the world is real and you have seen that one group cancels the other. So Gaudapada says, no, I need not interfere much because each has cancelled the other. Now the argument continues. It's a bit academic, but I shall try to make it as simple and as informal as possible. The work is highly technical. I shall try to make it as simple as possible. If any of you want to ask any question, we have just about 5 minutes and then we will conclude. Those of you who would like to go deeper into these subjects and would like to ask questions in each session, you are most welcome. You can write down your questions. And from a purely informal point of view of those of you who are students of philosophy, studying philosophy, from that angle also you can put questions. We will discuss. So we have got about 5 minutes. If anything you want to ask, you can ask. Now we have one announcement. We will not have class next Friday, October 11, because of our Durga Puja celebration the following day. So please remember, there is no class on Friday, next Friday, October 11. The next class will be on Friday, October 18. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat.